Welcome to Consequences of Our Culture podcast. Today we have a very special episode with a very special individual. I'm Randall, and today I have the privilege to sit next to and interviewing an individual that has experienced the lowest of lows and has risen from those said lows. He is a boxer, entrepreneur, a coach, and a public speaker. Today, we're here sitting with Mr. Joe Buckner. Sorry, I butchered your last name.
It's all good. Thank you for having me.
Oh, of course. Of course. You have a very interesting story. It's pretty cool. It's pretty wild. So how are you doing today?
I'm phenomenal. I'm fresh, you know, rarely stressed, blessed.
Yeah.
I'm good.
Watching your videos, I knew you were going to say something like fairly positive. So you're born and raised in Fort Collins?
Yeah. Yeah. My grandparents' house is like 3 minutes from here.
3 minutes?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. And your uncle got you into boxing at an early age, six?
Yes, yeah, my Uncle Tony, yeah.
Okay, so how did that come about? Like, one day he saw his nephew and, you know, was your uncle a boxer?
Yeah, my uncle was a fighter. Oh. So he was a two-time Golden Glove champ in the Marines. At one point, he was one of the top 10 ranked flyweights in the world. And I just come from a family of fighters, honestly. My family, my mom, her brothers, sisters, they were just known in this town as people that fought, and they were known as tough people. So we were raised tough, and my uncle was a state champion wrestler. So from a young age, we were taught to box and how to wrestle because it was important to know how to take care of yourself.
Oh, yes. I agree.
And so, you know, I remember being a kid, seeing my aunts and uncles fighting in the parking lot with people when they were adults. They weren't kids.
Wow.
So,
That's just what
we grew up with. And
in
so,
Fort Collins?
Yeah, Fort Collins, yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Yeah, there's tough people everywhere. Don't let anybody fool you.
Yeah, I got you.
But yeah, so they just thought it was really important for us, especially, I mean, even the girls were taught how to wrestle, how to box. So, yeah.
That's important. Like, I teach my children, well, you know, growing up, my parents were my dad was kind of the same way. Like, my dad was in the Marine Corps also, and he was in the Army. And my dad wanted to make sure I knew how to defend myself. So, you know, growing up, I took Tang Sudo and I took karate and just different stuff like that. So, you know, I knew how to, you know, properly defend myself if it came to it.
And amen.
And a lot of people don't take it as seriously as it should be, but I feel like every individual shouldn't be like defenseless. You know, if someone comes at them, they should be, you know, their first reaction shouldn't be to like curl up or submit or anything like that.
Yeah.
They should definitely be able to like take care of themselves. No.
And to your point, I would like to also add that understanding how to defend yourself actually makes you more calm in tense situations.
It does. Because you have nothing to worry about.
No, because you know how to take care of yourself.
Yes. Exactly.
And so that's what I've been telling people my whole life. Like, it didn't turn us into like a group of like Billy badasses.
Right.
But I've never been afraid of a human.
Right. Like,
right. And that's when bad things happen. We're afraid.
Exactly.
That's when you shoot someone because you're afraid they're going to beat you up.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
Versus I know how to take care of myself. And I'm probably going to talk my way out of this because even though I know how to fight, I don't want to fight.
Right.
No. I will, but I don't want to.
It's sad that, like, nowadays we've come to, like, a, you know, initial reaction, people's fight or flight. You know, they just like, oh, I got to take care of this. I got to take this person out. There's, like, no honor anymore. There's just, like, I have a problem with this person, kill him, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's sad. But, yeah,
would it be a problem if we pause for 1 second? I'm going to shut that off.
Okay, yeah. Okay, we're back. So how would you describe your childhood?
Not easy.
Not easy.
Like a lot of people's. My father was 16 and my mother was 18 when I was born.
Okay.
And then my dad left and my mom was still a young person. So my grandparents took me in and I lived with them for the first 4 years of my life, which was great. But then when my mom got me back, this was a kid trying to take care of a kid. But when she showed back up, she already had my brother. And then a year later, she had my sister. And so, you know, we moved around a lot. We were just one of those families that was always 30 cents away from a quarter, right? So my folks were just broke. And that's not the part that sucked. I saw like domestic violence in my home. You know, my stepdad was an alcoholic. And so that was the part that was tough. You're like little and you can't help your mom.
Yeah.
And so when you grow up and you see that, that's challenging and it leaves scars. And then also my dad never came back around. So you also grow up feeling like you're leavable because the person who was obligated to love you chose to leave you. So my childhood was tough. I started getting in trouble when I was about 13. On the flip side, I was a very gifted athlete. So that was the A side. The B side is I was always getting in trouble.
Okay. Gifted. So did you play any sports in school?
Absolutely, yeah. When I was in high school, I lettered in 5 varsity sports. I was an all-state football player and track athlete.
5 varsity sports? So you did football, basketball, baseball, soccer.
Track. Track, and then I played rugby 1 year just because, I don't know, I thought it'd be fun.
Yeah, rugby up here?
Yeah.
That's wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
And they've actually got a great youth rugby program here.
Okay. And you were and you continued the boxing?
No. So boxing was just something I would do just for fun. Okay. You know, I'm 47. So growing up, there wasn't anyone getting paid $100 million to box when I was young.
Yeah.
You know, so boxing wasn't glamorous to me.
Right.
Boxing was, this is how you take care of yourself. So, which I'm fortunate because I love boxing. I probably would not have gone to college to play football. I would have just been like, I'm going to box. And I have friends who took that route. And I will tell you now that their quality of life is not the same as what a 46, 47-year-old person's life should be from getting punched in the head so much.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, sports was my savior almost, because I don't know what kind of person I would have been without it.
Yeah, no, it's definitely good to, like, it was good for me also. Like, in high school, I played football mainly, but I also played like a little bit of basketball and soccer. And later on, I coached basketball and soccer, but that's just beside the point. It keeps you like occupied with something positive.
Yep.
And it also shows you how to work with other people, yes. How to work as a team and how to respect your opponent at the same time. And
it teaches you how to be coachable.
Yeah, exactly. And
take direction.
Listen.
Right.
You know, actually follow before you leave.
Yeah.
Yes, it does. Amen. Yeah, it does. And it was good for me because I saw like some of my friends that didn't necessarily have that. Like they had this free time. They would like, you know, spend times in the neighborhoods with like the wrong influence necessarily.
Where did you grow up at?
I'm from Montgomery, Alabama.
Montgomery, Alabama? Okay, yep. Cool.
Yeah. Born and raised. First 22 years.
Nice.
And they didn't necessarily have that direction. You know, I feel like a lot of times with people, the youth, it's about direction. Like if they lack direction, a figure to, you know, show them, you know, what's right and what's wrong, the proper way to go, like they usually, you know, follow into other people who haven't had direction also, and they go down the wrong path. But I had a pretty solid foundation. So you, at what age, because this is getting into the story, what age did you start selling furniture?
Oh, I was 25 years old.
25?
Yeah.
You started selling furniture here in Fort Collins?
Yes, at American Furniture Warehouse.
Okay. That sounds familiar.
Yeah.
But okay. And so while you were selling furniture, you were approached by someone wanting to buy, you know, ecstasy.
Yeah, Dan. I was approached by Dan.
Huh?
Dan.
Damn, you name dropping.
I ain't seen Dan since. And Dan knows he was wrong for what he asked me.
Okay. Yeah, he came to you and he said, "You're black."
He
like,
said,
"Do you know?"
He said,
"Do you
you're
know
black.
Where I could get some e pills?"
No, he said, "You're black. You know where I can get some drugs."
Right.
No, actually, I don't. I didn't. I didn't. I was like super square. I mean, I barely drank. Like, I still don't really drink. So yeah. I was like L7 square. Worked out. Worked. Went home. And he asked me that. And like now. So when I was young, I don't know that I was the best advocate for myself. And sometimes when you're the only black face, you're just trying to get along, right? Yeah. You don't want to be the angry black guy at work.
Right.
At 47, I would be him. And if someone asked me that question, we would have a problem. Mm-hmm. Right? I would check him. But like when you're young and you're just trying not to lose your job because you got benefits, you got kids, you kind of let things slide that you probably shouldn't. And so his question was way out of line.
Yeah.
But I helped him and I made a little bit of money.
Right. I feel like, well, like reading your story and like watching like the videos, your interviews and stuff, I feel like that was like a pivotal point in your life at that point. So
yeah,
it was like, you, I believe you said in 30 minutes, I made $100.
Yes.
And then like after that, you left the furniture store?
Not immediately after.
Not immediately.
You know, but I'm really good at simple math.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
30 minutes, $100, that's $200 an hour. And I was like, I make like $1,400 a week.
Right.
Right? And I work a lot of hours. And I'm not poo-pooing that. I mean, that was in like 2000.
You made $1,400
a week? Oh, yeah.
This is like back in mid-2000s?
This was like 2001, yeah.
2001?
Yeah.
Damn.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And,
but.
Right.
I had no context. I grew up poor.
Right.
So $5,000 a month. I'm like, I'm still poor. I have a Nissan Altima. I don't have a Benz. I don't have a right. Lamborghini. I'm poor. I'm poor. I'm poor. I'm poor. I don't want to be poor. And so the $100 to me represented real fast. I was like, oh, I could make $10,000 in a week. Mm-hmm. When you're poor, that's a lot of money.
Oh, it's a lot of money. Any, yeah.
I mean, it is. It is. But even if you think about 400 grand, like me and you could go out of this door and spend 400 grand.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. We could walk down the street. There's not a house you could buy for 400 grand here. So
yes, true.
Perspective, right?
Right.
So, but when you're poor, 10 grand might as well be 10 million.
Oh, 100%.
And so, yeah, that lunch changed everything for me but I didn't leave right away. He called again. I got him some more. I was like, this is easy. But the next time I brought my own money and I was like, well, let me get some for me. Because I want to see if people want these. And Ecstasy was just starting to take off. I mean, you're talking about 2000, 2001.
Right.
So here it was just starting to take off. So I called my friends. I said, we're going out. But really, I just wanted to be in the club and be like, who wants these? And I realized real fast, people pay $25 a piece for these. I paid $10.
I know.
So my $100 became $250.
I'm telling you.
I was like, wait a minute.
$15.
And I'm out hanging out. So I went back to the guy and I was like, I'm going to take some more. And then Dan had a friend who was like, I need to buy 100 of those. So then I went from this guy to this guy. And with his 100, with the profit from it, I just bought my own 100. I was like, if the price is $7 now and people are going to pay me $25 a piece for them, I'm all in. That was when I stopped working at the furniture store.
A lot of profit, yeah. And I feel like, especially for like our inner city youth, like that's like, super enticing. Like you've been in poverty most of your life, and then this opportunity comes around where you could make like super overhead, like super profit.
Yeah,
like you could double your profits, and you see a lot of people like see like nice things and say, "I want this. I want this. I want this. I want this." And when you finally get the opportunity to get that and grasp, like you know, you'll go for it. People will leave their jobs. They'll like. Move out their mom's houses to sell drugs. And But most of the time, it's like it could last for a long time, but most of the time it's temporary, honestly.
Always temporary.
It's like, because you don't, like, drug dealers don't retire, you know?
No.
It's like.
The 401k is garbage for drug dealers.
So, okay. So how long were you doing that before you got caught?
So I was a solid 3 years, and I want to make a clarification. I never got caught.
Okay.
I got told on.
Damn.
There's a difference.
Yeah. Damn.
There's a difference. I never got caught.
Was it Dan?
What's that?
Was it Dan?
No, Dan was way out of the picture.
Okay,
at this point.
Dan's out the picture.
Because I didn't work at the furniture store anymore, so I didn't even know Dan anymore. Okay. I should find Dan, though. Me and Dan should talk now.
Yeah.
22 years later.
Yeah, he's probably somewhere out in Denver.
Yeah, who knows? But so 3 years consistently. And then the way that it always works is a guy who works for one of your guys gets caught, tells on that guy. Right. That guy inadvertently trusts someone that he, because he's just being greedy, and that person somehow finds their way to you, and now you're under investigation.
Right.
So that's actually how it happened. But I always like to make that, I didn't get caught. I was on my game. I didn't get caught.
Yeah. Okay. So, like, so one day you're just at the house, at the crib, minding your business, you know. What is this? You're talking about, like, this is probably like 04. You're probably watching like King of the Hill or something like that, and they just like bust in and like get on the ground. And
no, no. So, God, I don't mean to even, I'm not trying to glorify any of this. I'm just trying to share real.
100%. So, it's terrible.
When you reach a certain level of that, someone's always watching you. So when I'd go out to walk my bulldog, I'd bought an English bulldog. I'd always dreamed of having one. I'd walk him. I would see unmarked cars down the street. Sometimes I go talk to him. Hey, what's up, y'all? I see you. Like, hope you're having a good day. And they, you know, kind of side-eye me. But I want you to know I see you. Like, I'm not going to do a drug deal in the middle of the street. So you're wasting your time. But I was going to the mall, actually. I was driving to the mall to buy an LA Clippers starter jacket because I was meeting a young lady out at the nightclub.
The Clippers?
Yeah, you in remember 04? Back then, the Clipper jacket was like that kind of red with the blue and white around the elbow. Said Clippers on it. Just a fly jacket. Okay. I didn't give a dang about the Clippers. The jacket was cool.
Yeah, I mean, no.
So I was going to grab the jacket because I was going to go out that night, and I was meeting, you know, my friends and a young lady, and I pulled out. And I saw a car following me. Cool. They follow me a lot. I don't care. I don't have anything with me but some money. And then, you know, we're playing the little game. I'm trying to lose them because I'm just messing around. And then a marked car jumps on at Shields and Prospect. And I'm like, oh, this is interesting. Whatever. Still don't care. Long story short, they pulled me over because my tags were expired. I was slipping, right? So actually, I did get caught this one, but I beat this case. So they pulled me over and, you know, hey, because your tags are expired, you know, we need to search your car. I was like, no, you don't. They said, well, yeah, we kind of do. And oh, by the way, your license is suspended. My license was suspended.
Dang. So you was riding real dirty.
I had no clue. So they put me in the car and they said, well, now that we have you in the car, we can search your car. I said, okay, I literally don't care. What I'd forgotten was there was a backpack in the car that had 11 pounds of weed in it.
Damn.
And not the good weed that people get millions of. There's a weed shop across the street. Not that weed. Like dirt. Like what was like, sold in 2000s. Like, yes.
Reggie. Like,
yes.
Bullshit.
Yes. But that's all there was back then, right? So so that's what was in the trunk, and I'd forgotten about it because I was supposed to drop it off early in the day, but I was just at home playing Madden. And I just laughed. I saw him grab the backpack, and I was like, whatever. So anyways, that's how it happened. But then they bonded me. I bonded out, and the search was bogus. All the things were bogus. So, like, I ended up beating those charges. But that's what happened. That's when things kind of started tumbling down.
Oh, you beat, like, those pounds of weed in the
truck? Yeah.
Damn, that's what's up.
I mean, you again, with the right attorney, like, the cops still have to do things right.
Correct. Right. There's proper procedure.
Right.
Right.
So just letting your dog run around the car and saying, oh, I found this, that's not right. And then the cop that actually did the arrest wasn't the cop that filled out the arrest report. The arrest report was a page long for a drug stop. It should have been like 6 or 7 pages. So my attorney, I hired him. He's like, I'll beat this in court. He was a former district. He was a former district attorney. He's like, I'll beat this all day. I was like, great, go for it.
Man, I had a good attorney, like divorcing my first wife. Probably the best attorney I've ever seen. But anyway,
yeah. The right attorney will make all the difference in the outcome.
It's way different than like a public defender.
Oh,
but
yeah,
but okay, so. Eventually, you know, you got caught. Mm-hmm. I mean, not caught. So you got told on and they picked you up.
Yeah.
And how did that feel? I'm guessing that was your first time in the back of a squad car.
Oh, no. No, I've been getting in trouble since I was 13.
Man, you're a wild boy.
I was just looking for my way out.
I get that.
I just didn't want to be poor anymore.
Yeah.
So whether it was stealing or like I was doing little petty things. What actually happened was when I beat those charges, they immediately filed other charges that they'd just been holding since October of 2002. This was in 2005.
Oh, they petty.
They petty.
Yeah.
This was April 2005. They filed charges on something that they said I did in October of 2002. Oh. That was the guy that had been brought to me through the other guys.
Yeah, they were determined.
They were determined. And actually at my sentencing, the judge said it's obvious there was some malice involved with the filing of these charges because you could have taken him off the street in 2002.
Right.
But you let drugs continue to be sold in our community. You let this continue to go on. Why did you sit on these charges?
Because they had a personal vendetta. Okay. So, you know, you're in court and, you know, you're standing in front of the judge and, you know, they read the charges or whatever.
Yeah.
And then, like, you know, sentencing, like, you know, they find you guilty. The judge announces sentencing. And it was like 5 years?
Yeah, so I went into court with an open sentence option of 0 to 12 years. So I could have gotten probation. I could have got 12 years in prison. And my public defender, because this time I was out of money, because I was out of the game already, because that the weed thing, I was like, I'm good. Like, I'm not doing this no more.
So you
right?
were done.
I was done. I worked at Safeway.
Wow.
Yeah.
So
when they filed these other charges, I was already like doing good.
Trying to be an outstanding citizen.
I was trying to be something.
Yeah.
And so I was broke. So I had a public defender the second time around. And I remember this joker tells me the night before, he's like, I looked at everything. Looks like you're going to get, you know, intense supervised probation. So there's a lot of parameters, but you're going to be good.
That's what your public defender said.
Yep. This was at like 10 p.m. the night before. I said, all right, cool. He said, that's what the DA is suggesting. The judge does not have to take their suggestion. I was like, right. He said, but 90% of the time they do. All right, bet. So kiss my kids bye in the morning. I'm like, hey, dad's got court today. And then the judge said, 5 years in the Department of Corrections.
Ugh.
And I was in shock.
Yeah, that's.
I was in shock.
It must have hurt. I know that had to hurt, like, especially having kids. Like,
being, absolutely.
Man.
Yeah.
That would kill me. So you're, I'm sorry. So the judge met them in the middle, gave you 5 years. Did you go to jail or prison?
So you go to the county jail for holding first.
Right.
And I was there for 2 weeks. And then I went to a Department of Corrections holding facility in Park County, which is commonly referred to as Gladiator School. So I went there. And then I went to DRDC, which is in Denver, which is a maximum security prison in Denver. And that's where you get classified. And then I went back to Park County before I went to Buena Vista.
Okay. All right. This is getting interesting, but we got to take a break.
Yeah.
We're going to take a short break. We will be back soon. Okay, we are back. Very interesting conversation, and we will continue it. So, so you went to these different, you know, correctional facilities. And so what was it like in there? Like, did you have to fight? You being a boxer, did that help? Or was it just like chill? Like, I have no idea, you know?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. Prison is its own little ecosystem.
Okay.
It's very political along racial lines. Right. Whites here, blacks here, Mexicans here, you know, everybody else. Those are the three main groups.
Right.
Within those groups, you know, like you could be black, but you might have been blood. You might have been a Crip, you might have been a GD, you might have been vice versa. So like within those little groups, you have your own little segmented groups.
Right.
So prison for me was easy.
Okay.
Easy in the sense of I didn't have problems.
Right.
Because I don't show up looking for problems.
Good.
Prison is the kind of place where if you carry yourself like a man, you mind your own business, you'll be good. So that's what I did. I just kept my head down. It's also a place where it's like the jungle. You can smell when someone's weak, and those are the people that get preyed on. God bless me. I've always had an air of confidence about myself. Like, I'm just not really him. Like, no one has ever tried to start a fight with me in my life.
In your life?
In my life. I'm 47 years old. I've never had someone try to start a fight with me.
That's incredible.
Ever.
Wow.
But, like, some people just move with that energy, right? And it's not like I'm a badass. It's like, I don't know. I'm not out here looking for trouble, so why are you messing with me? Whereas you probably know some people, like I know people, like they fight all the time. They're constantly in stuff. And some of these dudes are bad dudes. I'm like, how are you always getting into fights? Oh, well, he tried to blah, 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 and he came at me. And I'm like, that never happens to me.
Right.
So when I was in prison, it was the same. I mean, who wants to fight the guy walking around carrying a book and writing letters to his kids? Like, nobody wants to fight with that guy. He ain't doing nothing wrong. So that's what I did. I just kept my head down. Got my boot camp appointment, and then I went to boot camp, and boot camp changed my life.
Yeah. How so?
But prison's garbage.
Oh, prison's terrible.
I mean, I got paid $1 a day to clean the showers.
Right, no.
Prison's garbage.
Prison's, like, it's...
And it's a business.
It is.
And if you don't know it...
It's a profitable business.
You need
to
know.
People make money off of, like, having prisoners. It's...
I mean, you can invest in prisons.
It's... Yeah, it's... People own prisons. Like, it's important. And then it's... It's there's governments that have deals with these prisons that have a quota. They have to have a certain number of people. So it's kind of like they have an incentive to lock you up.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Thank God for the 13th Amendment.
Yeah. Yeah. What's the 13th Amendment?
The 13th Amendment abolished slavery.
Oh.
Unless under the terms of you committed a crime.
Mm. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, just watching, like, I don't know. I watched, like, a lot of prison reform stuff, and it's like, it's crazy, you know? Like, people will sell, like, cocaine and get, like, probation, but people will sell crack and get, like, you know,
absolutely
5 or 6 years. You know, it's crazy, like, how weed, it could be perfectly, like, legal, able to smoke in Colorado. But if you do that in Georgia, it's a wrap, bro.
Yeah.
You get the fuck out of here.
Yeah.
Like, nah, it's all messed up. It's,
absolutely.
But yeah. It's when you understand the economics of it, that it's a business.
Yes.
And you see why it's so corrupt and why it's 100%. Like so fueled by this. But, man, I forgot where I was going. So the halfway house.
Yeah.
So were you... selected off of good behavior? Was it random, or did you, like, you just volunteered to, hey, I'm tired of this place, I'm tired of these cinder blocks?
No, you don't get to decide anything.
I didn't think so.
Yeah, no. No, so there's a process. So for most people, the process is you go in, you start doing your time. After a certain amount of that time is up, you get reconsidered to go to parole. And you have to sit in front of a board and say, I'm sorry for all the things I did. And maybe, just maybe, they let you go home. These people that have never met you, and probably not a single one of them looks like you, get to decide whether you get to go home or not. My situation was different because I got the recommendation for that boot camp program. So I went to the Colorado Corrections Alternative Program for 100 days, which was a military-style boot camp run by some active and ex-military personnel, so Army, Marines, Air Force, and it was modeled after the Army's boot camp. So in that program, there was 3 phases. If you graduated, you could potentially get your sentence reconsidered.
Wow.
I started with 42 people in my group. We finished with 14. It's a hard program. My sentence was reconsidered. And they wanted to put me on probation, actually. They're just going to send me home. And I begged them to send me to a halfway house.
I remember that. Yeah, they were offering you probation. And you was like, no, I'm not. I don't feel like I'm ready.
I wasn't.
To, you know, necessarily be out in the world. Because, like, you know, probation's just, you being out, you're just checking in.
Yeah.
And you just, you don't get in trouble.
Nope.
Yeah.
But I didn't have anywhere to live.
Right.
I didn't have anywhere to live. I didn't have clothes. I didn't have shoes. So basically you're going to put me on the street and you're going to ask me to do right living on the street with no job, no house, no clothes, no nothing. Yeah. You're going to just shove me on my way and say, do good. Be a good boy now.
Right.
We didn't set you up for success, but do your best. So for me, I had to take it upon myself to set myself up for success, which is why I asked Lieutenant Quintana, will you please recommend me to a halfway house? And he thought I was insane. But I had made a decision that I was never going back to prison ever.
Right. Well,
ever.
You knew yourself. Like a lot of people, well, most people would have jumped at that opportunity because it's like, hey, you know, it's basically, it's I'm out, you know, I'm done. Yeah. And a lot of people would have jumped at that, but you knew that, like, me doing that, you weren't ready, and you didn't want to end up in the same situation.
Right.
Right. Like, it's good to know yourself. Absolutely. Like, to know, like, what tempts you and stuff like that. A lot of jail is made up of repeat offenders.
Oh, yeah.
And people, they get out and, you know, they hang out with the exact same people. And yes. Then, like, they need money or something. They'll do the exact same thing that got them to jail. They're being watched anyway.
Yep.
And then they go back.
Yeah, 75 out of 100 go back within 3 years.
Yeah.
So.
That's crazy.
Yeah. And I was very fortunate, though. When I came back, I knew a lot of the same people, but they were still doing the same things. And with love, they said, you know, we already know you're going to be watched, so we're not going to hang out with you anyways. But we also know you, and we know you don't want to go back there. So we're double not going to hang out with you. If we see you, it's love.
Right.
But don't call us. Don't come by. Like, we're good. And I was also good because I wasn't going back there. I needed to be there for my children. I needed to be a different person. So for me, the decisions were really easy, even when they were the hard decision. Sometimes the hard decision and the right decision are the same decision.
Yes. A lot of the time.
So going to the halfway house wasn't awesome, but I had a place to live. I got to eat. I got to get back on my feet before I went out on my own.
Right.
And that's what I needed.
Yeah. It was a good, like, step. Like, it wasn't just like out into the cold. It was like a gradual transition.
Yeah. And I wasn't going to be tempted to break the law.
Right.
But I was going to be tempted to figure out how to make decisions out of desperation. How am I going to eat? Where am I going to stay? That requires me to go out and make money. But I don't have a job. And it's hard for a homeless person to get a job.
Yeah.
No house, no phone, no. How do we call you for the interview? How do we? So we don't think about these things that are stacked up against people when they come out. And at the same time, they're not being told, here's what it's going to look like when you come out. It's just you're free.
Yeah. A lot of people don't consider other people's problems. They just go through life and they only worry about themselves. They don't see, like, necessarily, like, an ex-con not getting a job an issue. They're quick to say, oh, he put himself in that situation. Yeah. But, you know, understanding that, like, anyone is just a couple of bad decisions from being in jail.
Yeah.
You know? Like, there's, like, known lawyers that go into jail, you know?
Yeah.
Like, and it's hard for people. I mean, like, you want them to be a contributing member of society. You know, they need to do something. They can't just, like, be outside with no money, either, you know, contributing to being the homeless, or, like, you know, stealing or something like that. So, no.
If you think about it, like, most adults at some point have done something that could have put them in jail.
Yeah.
And I'm not even talking about egregious things. I'm talking about, it's Thursday. There's going to be a lot of people at the Rio tonight, and I doubt many of them are going to take Ubers.
Right.
The cops could literally sit out there and pick people off one after the other. And some of these people are upstanding members of the community, all that, whatever. You just haven't been caught. That's exactly the difference. You just haven't been caught driving your Lexus home after you had three margaritas at the Rio. God bless you for not getting caught. I don't wish bad on anybody. But don't put yourself in the I don't ever do anything wrong category, because you're just one decision away from being just like the rest of us.
Man, that's irresponsible. Three margaritas at a Mexican restaurant. Mexican margaritas are great.
Hey, people do it a lot.
Yeah. No.
A lot.
So at the halfway house, you called up your children's mom.
Yeah.
And you asked, you know, can you see them? Was that your first time seeing them in like a long time? Or?
So they had, my mother had brought them to my boot camp graduation. So I did get to see them when I graduated from boot camp in April of 2006.
They had a graduation.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
You said they had three phases. Was it red, white, and blue phase?
No, first phase, second phase, third phase.
Okay.
So, and then, you know, you graduate if you make it through third and your family gets to come. That's the only time. You don't get visits when you're in boot camp.
Was it 10 weeks?
100 days.
100
so,
days.
Yeah, 100 days. So I was there. I got there in January and I was done. My the day I found out I was going home was April 12th. So.
Okay, yeah. I was in the Army. I remember when you book kept, that's all I was
asking. Yeah.
But okay, so you know, how did it feel like to see your children and you know, them not having to see you like behind bars or anything like that? Like,
oh, it was the best. I remember my son was jumping up and down. He was on the other side of the deal and the lady was like, he can come over. Normally kids can't come right over, but he can come. And he came that. Running around the thing. And it was beautiful because I had always been very self-centered. Like, I'm just doing what I gotta do. Like, everything's gonna be fine. I never thought about how this was impacting my children. My mom, heck, their mom, even though we weren't together, like, leaving her with all that responsibility while yeah. I'm in jail, like, all of these people are being affected. And so seeing them just renewed my faith that being in this halfway house is the right choice. And I'm gonna do everything I can to get back with them as soon as possible.
Okay. What happened to the lady that you went to see the mall with when you got caught with the bag of weed? She's gone?
Oh, she's married to someone else, got some kids. Like, yeah. So.
You didn't want to hit her up after you got out? Oh, she was married when you? Okay.
No. I didn't. When I got out, see, that's another thing. You have to have a completely different mindset
right.
when you get out other than I'm going to go back to my old life. So I didn't date for a year. No, I didn't date. Good. And the big thing was, number one, I can't be distracted. Number two, who wants to date someone in the halfway house? And I know people do it, but my thought process was just like, I don't have a car. I sleep in a room with seven dudes.
Yeah, you really got nothing
I got to check in. Like, what can I offer someone of value?
Right,
and I want someone of value. So a year, I just focused on me, focused on saving my money so I can get out of the halfway house. And I got out of the halfway house in record time. I mean, I got out of there in like 4 months. Nope. They're like, man, you're good. Go.
Okay. And was it during the halfway house or right after? Like, it was probably during. You said your job was to find a job.
Yeah.
So every day you walked, 7 miles a day?
So I used to walk every day to look for a job.
Right.
But then I got two $7 an hour jobs and I would walk 14 miles a day between the halfway house and my two jobs every single day. Rain, sleet, snow, I walked 14 miles every single day because I understood nobody's going to hire me as the CEO of anything right now.
Right.
I just need an opportunity. I just need people to see how hard of a worker I am, how committed I am to changing my life. So whatever you have, I'll take it. And so it just so happened, both jobs were about 3.5 miles from the halfway house. And I worked both of them every day because also I didn't want to be sitting in the halfway house. It's desperate in there. It's sad.
It's sad, yeah.
It's dudes that would just sit in there all day. Oh, I can't find a job. I'm like, you're not looking hard enough.
Right.
You're not looking hard enough, my guy.
I could say I never had that problem. Well, I've never been unemployed for more than like a month.
Yeah.
Because like for me, I you know, before I was in the Army when I was younger, if I like got fired or like, you know, wrote off the schedule or whatever, I was always looking anyway. I was always looking for a job. Like, and then it was a numbers thing.
Yeah.
I would apply to like, I've applied to like 150 places at one point.
Yeah.
And then like it's enough, so at least 15 are going to call you.
Yeah.
You know? So like when people say I can't find a job. If they live in a city, I kind of see it as an excuse. Like you're not, you know, putting your best effort. You're being lazy. If you don't put in your best effort, you're just going to blame the system or society or whatever, and you're just going to, you know, sit on your ass.
Well, and they're not looking for a job. They're looking for a dream job.
Right.
Right. I can't find a job that's going to pay me $100,000 a year to do nothing, to just like hang out. Right. But someone that's determined is going to take whatever opportunity is in front of them because they understand my $7 an hour is better than your $0 an hour.
Exactly.
Something's I'm winning this game, right? And so that was me. And the other part of it too is, you know, for people that are listening, it's also how you show up. So when I was in the halfway house, I was respectful. I never caused problems. Yes, sir. Yes, ma'am. No, sir. No, ma'am. I followed all the rules. So one of the jobs I got, they called me down to the front desk at the halfway house because they saw me every day. I put on a suit, same suit, only had one, and I'd walk and look for jobs. And they saw how dedicated I was. They called me down to the front desk. The lady goes, I was just eating lunch at Gibbs Bagels, and they have a sign up that says they're hiring. I'm going to give you 2 extra hours of pass time to go apply for the job. I said, thank you. She said, I see how hard you're working. I see how you're trying. Go down there. So I went straight down there. Dude interviewed me on the spot. He was like, can you start Monday? I said, I could start today, but Monday's great. Right? So how we show up, if we show up, you know, in our prison clothes, pants sagging down, like whatever, like people aren't going to take you serious. You have to show up like, hey, I'm ready to make this change and be this next person because that person got sent to prison. Right. So I don't know if I want to be him anymore.
Right.
Okay. So how you show up really, really matters. And I wore a suit. Yeah. I wore a suit to interview at a bagel shop.
You got to look presentable because, like, it shows that there was effort put in there, you know? It shows that, like, oh, I'm not just doing this because I have to. It shows that I want to change my situation or I want to, you know, be here in this cell, you know?
That man said to me, why'd you wear a suit? Because he's wearing dirty T-shirts, shorts. He said, why'd you wear a suit? I said, because I need you to know how serious I not only take this opportunity, but how serious I take myself.
All right. No,
hired on the spot.
I wore a bow tie to an interview. And, like, I got the job, and my nickname was Bowtie for, like, a solid, like, year and a half. Like,
I don't know that I've ever worn a bowtie.
I was trying to be stylish. But we're going to take yet another break, and we will be back shortly.
Cool.
All right, we are back with Mr. Joe Buckner. And so you did these jobs, you made money. Eventually, I'm guessing, like, you got to a very sustainable lifestyle and you felt it on your heart or you had a passion for it. And you was like, you know, boxing, you know, I want to open a boxing gym. Or how did that, I don't know, I'm guessing, how did that go about?
In 2013, I helped open a place called Title Boxing Club, which is out south. Title? Yeah.
Okay.
And it was the first time in my life I'd ever seen regular people boxing. Now, they're not boxing, but, you know, hitting
like
bags.
Trying to box,
yeah, working out with gloves on.
Gotcha.
And I just fell in love with the idea of, you know, teaching boxing for fitness. And so I helped them open. And I went there for 3 years, and then I had actually moved up my station in life. You know, I'd gotten to a pretty good point. I was working in major accounts for business-to-business sales for a large copier company. And I'd built what I guess what a lot of people would call the American dream. You know, you make 6 figures or more, you got a nice house, nice cars.
I mean, you went from getting what, $1 an hour cleaning showers to
to $55,000 months.
Hey man,
it was good, right? And I hated every minute of it.
Okay.
I hated every minute of it. So my heroes are Malcolm X and Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.
Okay.
You know, being an athlete, people always assume I'm going to say, you know, an athlete or someone, but like those were my heroes, people that had impact, people that left a legacy, people that were willing to give themselves for the greater good. And that was always my calling. When I was a kid, I had posters of these men on my walls. Like, that's how deep it was for me. And so I just had this calling on my heart that I wanted to share this story that you and I have been talking about. But because I was calling on C-level executives, I kept getting the pushback, like, you can't share that story, Joe. Because if these people hear that story, they're not going to take your call anymore. And I used to think, you know, that's sad because that means I don't get to live authentically. I don't get to be me. And I want to share this story, not to edify myself, but because I think it can help somebody out there who's exactly. struggling. So I wasn't going to quit my job because I'd gone from nothing to something. And God has a funny way of forcibly removing things sometimes if that's not the direction you're supposed to be going.
Amen. Yes, he does.
And so I remember talking to my best friend, and he said, how's everything? I said, I hate my life. And he was flabbergasted. He's like, you've been homeless. You've been in prison. You, what do you mean you hate your life? I said, I don't like what I'm doing. He said, what would you do? I told him. I said, I'd open a boxing gym, and I'd play the coolest music, and I'd put people in a room for 45 minutes at a time, 4 or 5 days a week, and I would talk into a microphone and share words of wisdom and encouragement and really breathe life into people. But I'm never going to quit my job. And a few weeks later, my job quit me.
Hey, it happens.
They had put me in a national role at this point. And I got a call right before our weekly sales meeting. Hey, we just let go of our CFO. We just let go of the head of human resources. And unfortunately, because you're the only person that doesn't work in office, we have to eliminate your position also. And so I hear you. I'm faithful. I listen. Now what God was saying was, now the only thing between you and this is air and opportunity. What are you going to do? And to make it worse, I got a job offer that next Monday. Hey, heard you got let go. We want to come bring you in. We'll pay you the same salary. And so that was also, God allows us to be tested. God doesn't test us. He allows us to be tested, right? So that test was put in front of me because I had set my mind. I mean, I had a fiance at the time. I said, I'm going to open a boxing gym. I'm not going back to work. And she broke up with me. She said, I'm not going through that.
Damn.
She broke up with me. I said, I understand. I get it. Security is important to you. But I have to do this. I have to try. And that was 6 years ago. Within 2 months, I had the gym open. I didn't know my butt from my elbow when it came to running a business, but I knew I wanted to help people. I knew I wanted to serve people. And I knew that if I kept that as my North Star, I would probably be all right. And here we are 6 years later.
Yep. I believe in God. And I believe, like, if you're a good person, and, you know, if you continue to be good, do like the trials and tribulations, God will definitely reward you. If you don't, like, you know, waver too far and you continue being a good person, God will always, like, deliver. And you're right. Like, God will put you in a position. Like, God has I've lost jobs, and then, like, God has put me in somewhere else that was, I've lost jobs, have to work lesser jobs, you know, like lesser pay, had to go down. Like I had one job, I was, let's say I was making about like 65, you know, a year. And this was in like Georgia, so it's a little better than here, 65 a year, like too much here. But anyway, like then I lost that position and I had to go down and I had to work like at hotels and, you know, apartments. And then like, another opportunity came in my prior sector and I got paid, you know, twice as much as I was getting paid at the, you know, the prize job that I had. So, you know, God will definitely like put you in a position and you just got to constantly believe and have faith. So,
yeah.
And did you say 2016?
2016, yeah.
Right. In 2016, you opened Beautifully Savage. Okay. Why'd you choose the name Beautifully Savage? It was a representation of your life, or?
Sure. Okay. I never intended to just open a gym. My goal was to build a brand.
Okay.
A brand that's easily recognizable through the logo, through the name, through the apparel branding, through the way we present ourselves on social. I wanted to build a brand that was bigger than the four walls that we sit in. And I've always had an eye for like what's cool, what's coming. And I understood that if I called it Fort Collins Boxing, well, unless you go to Fort Collins Boxing, you're never going to want to buy a t-shirt or a hat or a sweatshirt.
Right.
Plus, that's just not sexy.
No, not at all.
And people need to be able to attach emotion to something to really stick to it, right? So boxing is beautiful. Like, really, it is. When you watch great fighters, combatants, it's beautiful. But it's also incredibly savage to ball up your fist and hit someone until they're unconscious. It's savage, right? Life, for the most part, is beautiful. A sunset, sunrise, falling in love, seeing your child born, it's beautiful. Life can also be incredibly savage. You know, one of the most successful guys I know in the world, he has everything. You know, $2 million house on the lake, beautiful family. We're together in Las Vegas and he gets a call that his wife has pain in her leg and she doesn't know what's going on. She goes to the doctor. She has stage 4 cancer and it's all through her legs and her spine.
Ooh, that's heavy.
Life can be incredibly savage.
Yeah.
Right? People from our inception are beautiful. If you put 5 little kids of different races on the floor, they just play.
Right.
They're not like, you're brown, you're brown. They just play, right? But people can also be incredibly savage too. We all have a dark side. So for me to be a whole human, you have to acknowledge that, yes, I am beautiful, but I also have darkness in me. And that's okay. As long as I can keep my foot on its neck, I'm good. But I know that it's there.
Okay. All right. So that's very beautiful, by the way, too. And yeah, life is beautiful and savage. There's a constant balance. Like, there's yin and yang. But other than that, what's the hardest part of, you know, running this place other than losing your fiance? Like,
oh no, that was a win.
Okay, I feel you. I feel you.
not because she's a bad person or I'm a good person, but you only want people by your side that are 100% on your side.
Right.
You don't have time for some timey people, right? So okay. That's a win.
Yeah. Now, you opened this place and you opened a location in Wellington.
Yeah, Wellington was actually the 5th one that we'd opened in the last 6 years. Yeah.
How many do you have?
Currently, we have 2 left.
Okay.
2 closed in COVID.
Oh, man.
That's fine. Wellington closed last week.
Damn.
So we have Cheyenne and we have 4 Collins.
Okay, Cheyenne. Okay. Okay. And, you know, the day-to-day operations are beautifully savage. Like, so, you know, you sign up, you come in, and you have like a 45-minute course. And uh-huh. You actually show, like, you know, those posers who are, you know, wearing boxing gloves how to defend themselves.
Yeah. So for us, that's everyone, because
right.
Most people don't know how to box.
That's true. I mean,
so we show them how to hit a heavy bag because they're here to work out. They're not here to be boxers.
Okay.
It's right.
More
so
exercise and anything.
They do 6 rounds, 15 minutes on the heavy bag, and then they do 15 minutes here on the floor doing functional strength movements. So whether it's, you know, swinging a kettlebell, squatting, pressing, pulling, you know, so we go through all the 4 primary movements. We hinge, we squat, we push, we pull, but we slam medicine balls, we jump rope, we train the way the fighters train. So it's the best workout around. It's probably the best workout in the country, honestly.
Okay. All right. And so, yeah, we'll wrap this up. But I just want to give you your flowers because, like, it's good to have examples, right? It's good to have people that you can necessarily relate to. That's, I mean, not necessarily saying it's for everyone, but a lot of people look for people to look up to. And it's good to, like, see a person who has, like, had it, you know, lost it, and, like, was able to build their way up. They just didn't give up. Like, you, like, you know, you were Nino Brown, and then They knocked you down. You was cleaning showers for a dollar.
I was.
Dollar an hour. And then you worked. You were willing to do whatever it took to build yourself up. You like walked, you know, you walked the walk. You like went miles. You worked yourself up to a decent corporate job. And then you realize it's like, you know, this might be good, you know, but this isn't necessarily for me. This isn't the glitz and the glamour. This isn't necessarily my calling. And, you know, God put you here and you opened, you know, this boxing gym. Well, this boxing training facility. And it really is a beautiful thing. It's beautiful for anyone to open anything, to have ownership, to decide to stop being a worker for the rest of their life and to actually, you know, be their own boss. That's a beautiful thing. But to come from like your situation and for you to constantly say, stay determined and stay on the right track and make it to where you are, it's a very beautiful thing. And I commend you on that.
Thanks. I appreciate it. Thank you so much. Yeah, I appreciate it.
And that is about it we have for today. Oh, you want to give them like your Instagram handles and all that cool stuff?
Yeah. So you can find me on Instagram at Mr. MR Joe Buckner, on TikTok at Joe Buckner. And I have a Facebook fan page too. It's also Mr. Joe Buckner. Or if you want to connect with me straight up, go to MrJoeBuckner.com. Shoot me an email. I reply to all those personally. Every single day I'm on them. So yeah, those are the four ways that you can connect with me.
Okay. And in the most poetic and beautiful way, who is Joe Buckner?
Joe Buckner is a father, a grandfather, a son, and a man who wakes up every single day trying to figure out how he can leave every person in place better than he found them.
Amen. And before we go, who's your favorite boxer?
Ever. Right now?
Ever.
Marvelous Marvin Hagler and Pernell Whitaker. My two favorite fighters ever.
Okay.
Tie. So I know you said favorite, but they're tied.
Right. I say Sugar Ray.
Sugar Ray, he was great. He was pretty phenomenal.
Yeah. Well, that's it.
Marvin Hagler beat him, though. Just for the record, Marvin Hagler won that fight.
Oh, wow. Damn. So that's it. You know, I hope you guys took something from this. This man didn't make excuses. You know, he made possibilities.
Amen.
And that's it for this week. Like and subscribe, and we'll see you next week. I'm Randall.
I'm Joe Buckner.
You guys have a great day.